Today's guest is Chris Parnham, who is the co-author of DeLorean, Celebrating the Impossible, and DeLorean Historian of Note. Chris is currently the historian of the DeLorean Owners Club here in the UK. According to my research, Chris has owned 17 DeLoreans and has managed to buy his original back. Chris, I've just scratched the surface a little in my introduction, so who is Chris Parnham?
Well, yes, Chris Barnum is retired, but Chris Barnum's had a long and active life. Started in the motor trade as an apprentice garage mechanic, eventually moved into the motorcycle trade, and then into industry at British Celanese, chemist and what have you. And then from there I started my own company, which was Derby Plating Services, which I ran successfully for over 30 years. And it was during that time that I reinstated my interest in classic cars, because actually I've been interested in classic cars since I first started in the garage trade. But when it morphed into being my day job, it does tend to take the shine off it. And when you're doing other people's bumpers and hubcaps and bits of trim and stuff day in, day out for 30-odd years, you tend to go off them a bit. So when I eventually got back into cars, I thought, well, I'll try and find a car that is devoid of chrome plating and something that you don't have to be welding and bodging and, sorting out paintwork, because that was the pain of my life before. So that's, and now I'm retired, so I spend all my time mucking about in the garage and mucking about with me DeLoreans and other cars.
Sounds similar to me. I kind of was doing it as a job, and then it got a bit of a chore and everything else. And I ended up sort of doing other things as a hobby. And you move away from it, don't you? That's
That's right,
the thing,
yeah.
I think. But why DeLoreans, I guess? But I think you kind of just answered that a little bit about not having chrome on it, I guess.
Well, yes, that was a certainly big attraction initially. But the main reason actually was I used to go to the NEC Classic Car Show every year with our Derby plating stand. The firm's still going, incidentally, but I've no involvement with it now. But while I was there, I used to wander around the other stands, as you do, and the DeLorean stand always got a wonderful stand, and yet it was only a tiny club. And this was because one of the joint founders of the club is a chap called Dave Howarth, who is now our president. But his day job was building stands for people. So, of course, we used to punch above our weight with our stands. And but they were very welcoming people. I don't know if many of your listeners, I'm sure, will have been to the Classic Car Show in Birmingham in the autumn, usually November, and wandered around the different stands. And some of them, I shan't mention names, but are a trifle standoffish, if you'll forgive the pun. They certainly don't encourage people wandering around. They have chains across the entrance and look from the barrier and all this stuff. Well, the DeLorean Owners Club's never been like that. It's always been a very friendly and welcoming club. In fact, it welcomed me a couple of years running, and that's what really sparked my interest. Dave Howarth and the rest of the people on the stand, were very helpful and let me sit in them. And the more I sat in them and thought about them, I thought, I like these. They're very distinctive. There's no welding, no rot, and no chrome, and it's got things like air conditioning and central locking, so it ticks an awful lot of boxes for me.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's a great reason to get involved as well. I mean, I'm a member of a few clubs. I've got a model, not 29 Model A, and I'm a member of the Model A club, and I've got a Herald for my wife. So,
All right.
you need to have the club sort of infrastructure around it to make it enjoyable, don't you? I think that's part of the.
Yes, and of course, the DeLorean Owners Club was actually founded in 1996 when the interweb wasn't really going. And up until then, any DeLorean owners in England, and there was a few because we'll probably come on to this later, but during receivership and after receivership, a lot of cars are actually sold off in the UK.
Yes,
These were cars that should have been scrapped. These were pre-production cars and early pilot cars and all sorts of cars. But when people actually went to Measham Auction British car auctions in general, they were flogging them off all over the UK. When people end up buying one, they couldn't actually put them on the road in those days because the government put all sorts of obstacles in front of them. And it was several years before anybody could actually register one for road use. But without the internet, people were literally on their own, and that's why the club was founded, to give people access to, you know, to spares and knowledge and all the rest of it. And, of course, as the internet's got more important, you know, that we have a club website, DeLoreanOwnersClub.co.uk, and there's another one as well, another DeLorean club that's started for people that don't like to pay the subs. We publish a very nice colour magazine, which we find is very attractive. We do that four times a year. Again, punching well above our weight. When you consider that the club has normally got around 300 full-time paid-up members, but which is tiny for a specialist car club, but we really do produce some nice stuff, which, of course, it's actually nice to hold a magazine and flick through it and look at last years and look at them 10 years ago.
No, I agree, because
The DeLorean was sort of self-selecting, really.
Yeah, I agree on the magazine and the tactile side of it, because I subscribe to Hemmings Classic Car, and I look, because my main thing is kind of American cars, but I like to have a magazine and something to read. It's certainly, you can look at things online and everything else, but it's not the same as having the magazine to read. So it's
no, exactly.
You're definitely right. What classics do you currently own, if that's not a silly question?
Well, I've got a Peugeot 205 GTI. That's a ragtop GTI. Mm. But even that's a bit special. I sort of inherited that. Well, actually bought it off my son, who bought it more than a decade ago, and realised he got something a bit special. It was an automatic with air conditioning, and one of a tiny batch of 10 that were intended for the Japanese market, but it got cancelled. So anyway, that's in my garage, and funnily enough, it's actually on sale at the moment on eBay. Because I've had it for a decade in my garage, looking after it, but I've only ever driven it for an MOT, and it's not really my thing. You know, I like it, but I'm not an enthusiast of them. Yeah. And then my daily driver is something a bit weird, which is a Rover 75 diesel.
Oh, okay.
But I tell you what, I've had a few Rover 75s, a couple in the past, both petrols, a 1.8 and a 2.5. But the thing is that most people know Rover 75s will know that BMW was in charge when these things were being made. And the petrol engines have a few issues, the 1.8s overheat if you're not careful. The 2 litres and 2.5 V6s tend to run out of cam belts if you're not careful, and they're both not particularly economical. But the BMW diesel engine one, with the M47 diesel engine, is a fantastic beast.
Yeah.
It's extremely economical, very rugged and reliable. It's got a chain instead of a cam belt, and I think they're brilliant. They're absolutely fantastic value for money. It only stands for it £1,000. It's got leather, dual zone climate, automatic wipers, cruise control, you know, alloy wheels, got everything, and it's just my daily hack.
There's a gent around the corner here for me, actually. He's got two of them, and he's had them, seems like he's had them for years, and they always seem in lovely condition and not showing too much sign of any rust or anything like that. So, no,
my ambition is to find a really low mileage one. This one has done 164,000 miles, but you wouldn't know it driving it. In fact, I've been out for a long trip in it today, and it goes like a train, and does over 40 to the gallon. I mean, you can't complain at that, can you?
No, you certainly can't. What's your favourite classic? Again, maybe a silly question.
Well, actually, thinking about it, I think it still is the DeLorean. I mean, I worked it out the other day. I'd had well over 100 cars. And I'm not a car dealer, never been a car dealer. Including my 17 DeLoreans. Everything from, well, my very first car was a Bond mini car, three-wheeler thing with a Villiers engine. You used to have to kick under the bonnet. That was a horrible thing. Then my very first motorised thing of any sort was a Cycle Master, which was a winged wheel. You used to put in a push bike frame, And then everything from V12 Jags and Land Rovers and Range Rovers and mostly British stuff. I've never had a BMW or a Mercedes, but apart from that, I've more or less been around the block. Well, not the posh cars. I've not had any Ferraris or Aston Martins.
The fact you mentioned the Bond is interesting because I interviewed Paula Cooper from the Bubble Car Museum a while back, and she's got all sorts of micro, well, what they call, the American listeners call micro cars now, but
yes,
she's got just about everything now, and there was some cars there that I'd never heard of in my entire life. It was very strange, and it was
of course they don't take up much space, do they?
No, she's got a huge collection of them.
I mean, motorbikes even better, of course. Motorbikes take up very little space.
Definitely.
But the mini cars and all those micro cars don't tend up a lot of space. A Rover 75 diesel estate takes up quite a bit of space, and a DeLorean takes up a fair bit.
Yeah.
So there you go.
I've got five cars. So,
yeah, well, I'm just trying to think what I've got. Our daily driver is actually a Kia Sportage, a diesel automatic, which is a brilliant thing. That's only the second car I've ever had from new.
Mm.
It runs rings around the Volkswagen Touareg I had before that.
It's a
fantastic bit of kit. And it's 7-year warranty. It's halfway through that now, and it just does the job, and it goes like stink. In fact, it's got a button that you economy button. Now, if I don't have that pushed in, I find that every single time I pull away, and it's permanent four-wheel drive, every time I pull away from junctions and traffic lights, I used to squeal the wheels. So in eco mode, where it changes up a bit later, we don't get that problem. But again, that does 33 to the gallon.
That's what you want.
The Rover does certainly over 40.
What about your, have you ever had an attack of buyer's remorse where you've bought something and thought, oh dear?
Well, yeah, I suppose I've had that a few times. I had that when I first bought this second Rover. Well, it's not the second diesel Rover 75, because I ended up putting all four new springs on it and all sorts of stuff. But you know, that's just a challenge. But my remorse really is one I didn't buy. I was I'm constantly cruising through eBay and looking at the classic cars, non-specified or whatever they call it, the miscellaneous ones, and this one popped up, and it looked like a frog-eyed sprite, but it was one of these cars that made a very tiny batch of them in, I think it was the Isle of Wight, and they'd got a BMC, a Rover petrol engine in them, and proper mechanics, and it was a proper one-off car. They only made a handful. I see one regularly when I go on our classic night meets. But this thing, it looks like a frog eye. It drives like a modern car. And they're cheap. When I saw this one, I took my DeLorean up to a place called Dale Abbey, not far from us in the Midlands. And I saw this little yellow car. And I'd been watching one on eBay. And the one on eBay, it was this car. It wasn't a kit car. It was a small production car. And it said that it had been laid up for 10 years and recently recommissioned and needed a few bits and bobs of work. But the photos, it looked brilliant. And it sold for 1,600 quid.
Wow.
£600. Mm-hmm. Now, this chap with his lovely little yellow version of it, which I know he's put a lot of work into, but I mean, that must be worth £3,000-£5,000 without even trying. And of course, if it was a genuine frog eye, it'd be £10,000 or £15,000.
Oh, definitely. I mean,
and it'd be rotten. Well, it would have been rotten at one stage in its life. There's a friend of mine got one who's rather tall, and as he sits in the passenger seat, his chin is above the windscreen, but the reproduction one, you sit a bit lower, and I just wish I'd bought it, and I hesitated, and I've never seen another one come up sale.
I'm sure you'll find one eventually.
Well, yeah, but I need to get rid of the Peugeot to make room in the garage.
There you go.
I don't like my cars standing outside.
Yeah, I've got because I've got my Model A in the garage here. I've got a Chevy truck that I bought a proper cover for that goes outside, and my Herald's down my dad's. So that's
Yes.
the trouble. What about seller's remorse when you've sold? And I guess it might
Well,
be your
two. Yeah,
DeLorean, maybe, but.
there was two. I mean, one of them is the DeLorean that I bought back again, one of my current DeLoreans, which is my very first one I bought in 1999. It was one of only three factory right-hand drives. It was going to be the British version of the DeLorean. But unfortunately, John DeLorean was set up by the FBI and fell into their trap, and that closed that essentially the business was already due for resurrection. The team of previous managers were going to rev it up again, but when John DeLorean was arrested with his suitcase full of cocaine in a hotel room in America, despite the fact that he was found not guilty a couple of years later, that was the end of the project. That car, one of those three cars, would have been displayed at the NEC car show, not classic car show, in 1982. But he was arrested the day after, and it never went there. So it's a very rare car. It's a right-hand drive automatic, grey interior, which I like. And I ran it for several years, and then I bought another. They're a bit like buses, you know. You go around looking for a decent car, you find one, and then all of a sudden you see them everywhere, don't you?
You do,
Well,
you do.
this chap phoned me up and he said, "I've got a DeLorean for sale." I said, "I've got one, thank you." He said, "Well, it's a right-hand drive." I said, "So's mine." And he says, "It's very low mileage." And I said, "Yeah, well, so's mine." And he said, "It's in an auction. It didn't reach its reserve." And I said, "Well, what was its reserve?" And he told me, and I knew that. I mean, I was quite into right-hand drives by then. I've actually had six of them up to now. And when he mentioned his reserve, and I said, "It didn't sell." And he said, "No." He says, "Well, it's not running." He'd sent it from the Isle of Man, had it shipped to the UK, and they'd not really looked after it and sold it at auction as a non-runner. Well, it didn't sell. So anyway, I made him a bid, which was his reserve price. He said, "Well, if you want it that, you can have it." So my wife and I drove all the way down to Southampton, which is about 250 miles from where we live in the Midlands, and I bought it the next day, and we arranged to have it delivered. So I'd got this other one that I was driving, this new one, and when this chap came along to me and he said that I want a right-hand drive DeLorean, I said, "There aren't many." He says, "It's got to be a grey interior." I says, "That's even fewer. There's only four." And he says, "It's got to be an automatic." I said, "Well, that's pinned it down again." He says, "There's only two." I said, "I've got one of them, and it's not for sale." Anyway, he made me a daft offer, which I thought was a daft offer. So I thought, "Well, I've got the other one." So I sold it to him. But almost as soon as the transporter had taken it away, I regretted it. So when he phoned me up 7 years later, well, I got this phone call and I thought, I recognise that voice. He came, it wasn't the owner, it was the man who looked after his collection for him. The owner was a solicitor based in the Philippines, English bloke. But anyway, this chap down at Devon or Dorset, he was looking after his collection. So when he phoned me up, "Was that Mr. Farnham?" I said, "Yes." I thought, "I'd recognise your voice." He says, "About a DeLorean." I says, "What, the right-hand drive?" And he says, "Yes." Anyway, to cut a long story short, this chap had an unfortunate marital situation and a divorce, and his wife was getting his collection of classic cars, plus some of his English houses, and so it was obviously up for sale. But it was the week after I'd appeared in a TV program called For the Love of Cars with Philip
Yeah,
Glenstone.
I love that
Well, I
series.
was,
Yeah, that's
yeah, well, I
great.
was the right-hand drive expert that wheeled on to look at another one they were doing up. And of course, it was sold at an auction and it made good money. And so when this chap phoned up and he said, "What's it worth?" I said, "Did you see that program that was aired the other night?" And he said, "Yes." I said, did the ex-wife see it? Yeah, she did. And well, that's dropped my legs from underneath me. But anyway, I know this car had got a few faults, and it still had. It'd done nothing to it, apart from driven it 700 miles in the 7 years it was away from me. So anyway, I bought it back at his silly price, plus 10%. They were happy, I was happy, and I got my car back. So that was the one that got away, but I managed to get it back again.
Have you still got that one now?
Oh, yes, that's why. In fact, it's very poorly as of today.
Ah.
I was taking it for an MOT yesterday, and there was these horrible crunching, groaning noises coming from underneath it. Mm. And having investigated it, I found that the diff had got hardly any oil in there, and it's... basically, it's disintegrated, so
oops.
I've got to sort that out. That's going to be another gearbox, which is a bit of a pain.
Yeah.
But there you go.
Is that a Renault box?
Yes, it is. Renault, is it UN1?
Mm.
But it's an automatic, that one, which is... I believe they're quite common. The people put them in all sorts of weird and wonderful cars.
Yeah.
But it's an auto, you see, so it makes it a little bit trickier.
Yeah, a little bit more expensive to it, I guess. You said you had you said you had a second one that got away. What was that one?
Oh yes. Well, I also bought another DeLorean, but it was a left-hand drive one. I've not had many left-hand drive ones. Most of mine have been right-hand drive, and it was that again was at an auction. Didn't sell. This is before they became really popular. And its reserve price was £10,000, and it didn't make it. And it had done 110 miles
ooh.
From new. And it was one of the very last ones made. It was a 1983. It was a grey interior, which is desirable. Manual, which is very desirable. So it had ticked every single box, other than the fact it wasn't running. And the killer on it, because of its the chap that had registered it previously had not really done much of a job on it. They'd not ascertained the year. And so it had been given, in the UK, they give them Q plates. Q something, something, something. Now that is really, Q stands for sort of queer, not quite right.
Yeah.
And it's sort of the kiss of death to any a kit car or something. They don't look good, Qs on them. But I thought, well, I'll take a chance on this. It's got to be right at that right money. And once I got it back home, it took me a week of talking to the DVLA, the licensing authority, to get the number plate sorted out properly. They'd not heard of 83 ones. They only made a handful of them. But anyway, we sorted it out. We got a proper 83 number. And I got the thing running. It didn't take me more than an afternoon to get it running. And I started driving it, and it was one of the last ones made, and it was so everything was so right about it. Tight, nothing squeaked, rattled, everything worked. And I ran it on and off for a couple of years, and I made the mistake of turning it into a Back to the Future car. Because they were just coming out, and I had the very first running Back to the Future car in the UK. Now there's a dozen of them, literally.
Funny you should say that. I was in a traffic jam on the M4 about 2 months ago, and one overtook me on the back of a lorry.
Yeah, well, I know who that'll be. That'll be Ollie Wilkins. His tends to go round on the lorry.
Yeah,
but I
white
used to
truck.
Drive mine.
Yeah,
and
okay.
When I put the Back to the Future gear on it, the chap called Chris Nicholson, who is the world's leading stainless steel expert, happens to live on Canby Island in the UK, goes all over the world fixing these DeLoreans. Well, he'd started making these DeLorean Back to the Future kits, and I was the first one to have one, and I got Chris to fit it for me, and we fit it in with a method where never drilled a single hole in the car, never altered anything. We picked up from existing fixtures and had other pieces made. So, in other words, I ran it for a couple of years as a Back to the Future car. But it turned into a business. I mean, I'd already got my business. I got my Derby plating business, chrome plating. And I didn't want another business. Chrome classic cars for me are a hobby.
Yes.
But when somebody says to you, right, I want you to stick it in this shopping centre for a couple of days and we'll pay you £2,000, I mean, it's very difficult to say no.
Correct, yes.
So, So after a bit of that, I took all the gear off it again and put it onto a cheap old banger, which still looked lovely, and I got my 1983 car back. But by then it had done quite a few miles, well, I say quite a few, 2,000 or 3,000. Mm. But sometimes, because it was a working job, if you like, some of them had been in the winter when I would never normally drive any of my classic cars in the snow and things like that.
Yep.
And so it was not pristine underneath anymore, but it drove lovely still. And somebody came along and offered me a decent price for it, and I reluctantly sold it. Without all the gear, as I say, I'd already put that on another car. But it was so right, because it was one of the last ones made, and because it was virtually, well, even when I sold it, I think it only done 3,000 miles. It was no more than that. So it was lovely and tight. Everything worked. It was just a beautiful car, and I wish I'd not sold it. So that I wish I'd not sold that one even more than the right-hander I'm driving at the moment, because that one was just... There was absolutely nothing wrong with it.
Well, you never know. You might get a chance to get it back one day, I guess.
Well, I might do, but I have actually communicated with the chap a couple of times in the past, and he shows no signs of ever wanting to part with it. I've not pursued it because I need to make some more garage space before I go looking for new cars.
I was just going to ask you, actually, what your roles within the club have been since the beginning, I guess.
Yes, well, when I joined the club in about 1997, without checking, it'd been going a couple of years, and the chap, the other joint founder of it, chap called Simon Lees Milne, he was into classic cars, and him and Dave Howarth, who I'd already mentioned, who's now our club president, they were the two that started the club. And when I joined a couple of years later, Simon was tearing his hair out trying to get material for the magazine. This is before the interwebs. And he was ready for throwing the towel in. And he said, he was, obviously, it's worn him down, you know. Funnily enough, I was actually at a big, in fact, they've just had one a fortnight ago, DeLorean five-yearly event in Northern Ireland where they meet at the factory again. And I was at this one about 2000, I can't remember the exact date, and I heard these two Americans talking to each other, and one of them said, there's a UK club, you know, and the other chap says, yeah, but he says, it's only been going a couple of years, I can't see it, it'll fold soon. And I thought, that irritated me. You know, I was a new member of this new club, and I knew that things weren't going so well, and so I my hackles raised. And I thought, well, it won't blow me a fold if it's left to me. So I said to Simon, I said, oh, Simon, I said, you're struggling a bit with this club, aren't you? He says, yes. I said, do you fancy, can I take over as secretary for a bit? Yes, you can bloody have it, he says. So I had it. And Dave and I worked together, and when I joined, I was member number 40. And by the time I relinquished my secretaryship about 10 years later, we'd got 400 members then. And it's sort of steadied off around 300 members ever since. Paid up members.
That's good. What about, how did the book come about then? This is it, that's interesting.
Well, again, this, that starts back to the early days of the internet. I used to follow a thing called, well, I can't remember the exact name of it now, but it was an American forum. I think it might have been DeLorean Talk or DMC Talk, but there's been several that's come and gone. And there was this one email that I saw, and somebody asked a chap called Larry something, I'll never forget. He asked an innocent question. He said, did they ever build any right-hand drive DeLoreans? And somebody else answered, who was high up in this interweb club, and said, no, they'd got plans to, but they never did. Now, at that moment in time, I was secretary of the UK club, and I'd got four right-hand drive DeLoreans, all built by the factory. And so this irritated me somewhat, so I fired off an email back, said, yes, and they did actually make them. They made over a dozen, plus these, some of them are subcontracted out to a firm called Wooler Hodeg. That was a dozen of them made there, and then there was these three or four that they made in the factory. So there was about 16 of them. And I said, yes, they did actually make them. And I was talking to Andrew Withers, he was then the newsletter editor, and it wasn't a newsletter, it was a full glossy magazine. That was Andy's part-time job, being a graphic artist as well as a computer expert. And I said to him, I said, you know, I said, there's a lot of ignorance kicking around in the world, because it was internet, it's the world, about what happened, who did what was built. I said, I think there's space to do a book here. He said, well, I'm up for it if you are. Well, that was 16 years ago. So we started collecting bits and bobs for our book. It was only ever something that was on the sort of a thought we might do it. And then in 2002, we were visiting Northern Ireland again. I think it might have been one of these gatherings. And we actually discovered the entire factory archive of photos at a firm called Ezra Crawford Photography in Belfast. And he's still got all the negatives. And he'd never been paid. Anyway, we went to see him. And his offices were basically in an old terraced house with old wooden shelving upstairs in the roof space and things. And it had got priceless boxes of negatives, and because it was all chemical photography in those days, and they were everywhere. The DeLorean archive sort of filled about six shoe boxes, but it was enough. There was over 2,000 different images, and we eventually ended up doing a deal with them, which cost me a lot of money. In fact, I could have bought a fixer-up DeLorean for the price I paid for the photos. It certainly would have made me more money. It would have been a much better business proposition. But then again, the book was never about business. It was about putting the record straight. We'd met so many people over the years who were involved with the building of the car, purchasing people, engineers, people from the factory, loads of them. When we go to the NEC Classic Car Show, you get people coming out of the woodwork. Oh, I used to work at so-and-so in the West Midlands. We used to make that bit for them. And I always got a notebook with me.
Yeah,
we were gathering all this information, but it just needed to be brought together.
My father-in-law is from Northern Ireland, so...
Oh, right, well, he'll know all about it.
He does,
It was in 2013 that the chap called Nick Sutton, who was the purchasing manager, published his own book. DeLorean, The Scandal. I'm sorry, Nick, I can't remember the exact title of your book. But if you Google Nick Sutton, he did this excellent book, which is from his own perspective of, and he'd not consulted with many of the people that we were in touch with. But it was a great book, but it was a spur to us. We realised that we'd really got to get this book of ours moving. And that's when Andy and I revved it up, and it took us another 2 years to get our book out. And, of course, it's got all these photos from the original photographer. So that turned it into a monster book, because there was no point in having scans of negatives, which are 27 meg. You know, we've got the films, and we scan them with some super-duper scanners we've got. And you get all this fantastic detail. I said, well, we can't cram this into a normal book because you don't see them. So we ended up with a coffee table book, which weighs 8 pounds, which is a foot square and 1.5 inches thick. Wow. And it's a monster book. And the reason is, not only has it got the text in there, some text, boiled down text to the bare minimum, telling the complete story, but it's got all these lovely photos that people can sit and look at, and, you know, the amount of people who say, well, I've seen my car there, you can see the VIN number. They have this happy habit of writing the VIN number on the back of the chassis, and when they put the body on it, they put a big piece of polystyrene on the back, like a bumper thing, stop them damaging each other, and they put the number on there as well.
That's
so
handy.
You see all these numbers around the factory and in the car park, and if you magnify it to a high enough resolution, you can see all the VIN numbers, which is brilliant. You know, for DeLorean anoraks like us, that's just what you love.
Have you still got all the photos?
Yes, oh yes.
Oh, yeah,
I've let lots of people use them. And including a chap called Barry Wills, who helped. He was the director of purchasing, and Barry helped us write our book. He was going to be part of our book, but then he realised halfway through that he got so much information that he'd managed to drag up from his memory and from his contacts. So he decided to write his own book, which he's done.
Actually, if you Google a podcast called Cars Yeah, there is an interview with Barry Wills about his book.
And I'll tell you what, there's another, somebody put a link on our website only a week ago. There's a fantastic private documentary, which is also on the internet. It's on the YouTube. I can't remember the name of it now, but it's a fantastic one. Barry features in that, but so do a lot of the other people. Colin Spooner.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that one.
Yeah,
it's on YouTube.
It's really good.
Yeah, it's on YouTube.
Colin was a brilliant... And his brother as well, Brian. I went to meet those. In fact, they've both got, well, obviously, copies of the book now. They all contributed. Lots of Lotus people. They were fantastic, because I'm sure most people know that Lotus did all the development work for these things.
Just going back to the club a little bit, we know it was formed in around 96 and you got involved in 97, and you've got about 300, 400 members currently?
Yes, it'll probably be nearer 300 now. Mm. I retired from being secretary in 2006. I can remember that because we'd come back from a big meeting over in Norfolk, and it drains you. I'm sure you might have been involved with organising events and things.
Oh, yeah.
But it can be very, very taxing.
It certainly
and I thought,
is.
Well, I've done my stint, and I retired then and took up the less onerous office of being club historian, which tied in nicely with the production of the book.
What does the membership cost for anybody who wanted to join?
It's not changed since 2007, because the chap that took over from me only did it for a year, a chap called Mike Bosworth, and he put the subs up from £20 to £25, and they've remained at £25 since 2007.
Hmm.
So they're still £25, and that gets you four huge, well, not huge, but big colour, properly produced colour mags a year, plus all the other benefits of cheap car insurance and a certain amount of spares. We do difficult to get spares, but with the aid of the internet, there are quite a few people producing spares now.
Yeah, I did notice that. What about events for the club sort of in a year? Is there a number of events or?
Yes, last year I organised one at Lotus again. We'd been there, the last time we went to Lotus was 2006. We have an event every year. This one coming up is near Silverstone, nearly Bletchley Park, code breakers place.
Yep.
That's where that one is going to be in September. So every year we have one major event, but because with the aid of the internet, people often say, right, what are we doing next weekend? And half a dozen cars will turn up somewhere.
Yep.
And,
I remember the one on Wheeler Dealers. There was a load of them, weren't there? I dare say you were around for that one as well, I guess.
Well, I didn't actually make that one. That's a long way from where I live. And having been down to the for the love of cars job, 2 days filming for my, I think it's about 2 minutes that this old gentleman comes on and mutters in front of the camera. You know what it's like. There's an awful lot of stuff gets cut out, but... it was good fun.
But out of the two shows, actually, I prefer For the Love of Cars, I think, because I think Anstead is a sort of genuine car designer type fella, and it's...
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I've discovered recently that a lot of television programmes, you can't believe a word of it, to be honest.
No.
it's... all right, I'm just taking the meat out of the oven. There we go. Santiago. A lot of them are sort of real put-up jobs. You can't believe a word of it.
No.
But there's absolutely genuine the For the Love of Cars one.
Yes. Yeah.
And the other one I like is the can't remember the name of it now. Is it Bulls,
Car SOS? Yeah.
That's right.
He's another genuine guy, isn't he? In terms of and he's from around your way as well, isn't he? So it's,
is he?
Yeah, he's in the Midlands there somewhere.
Yeah, West Midlands, I think.
So he's genuine. You know, I like them when they're genuine guys because it's reality TV, but not as we know it.
That's right. Well, like I say, I've never actually met him. I've met a lot of the others at car shows and things, but he certainly seems a knowledgeable chap that's not afraid to get his hands mucky.
No, and he's a very successful rock musician as well.
Yes, I understand.
Yeah, a drummer. So it's interesting, isn't it? What products and services? You touched on the insurance, but what products and services does a club offer?
Well, bits and bobs, spares, and Dave Howarth, our club president, he, whenever he finds any quantity of spares of anything or anything DeLorean related, he tends to buy it. And then he tends to pass it on to club members at cost price. I remember years ago, when you couldn't buy a windscreen for one of these things, he got one of the last existing original windscreens, and he had 10 made by a windscreen firm, because that was the minimum order.
Yeah. Excellent.
And they cost him £400 each, so it was £4,000 he paid out. And I think it took him a decade to sell them all, because I had one off him, and he sold them for £400. You know, that's Dave all over.
That's it, though, isn't it? I mean, that's a, you know, a proper club man, isn't it? That's the.
But now you can actually buy one. Somebody else, a big windscreen firm, must have got involved, or probably due to today's pattern, and they're readily available now for that sort of money.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. What are the future plans for the club? Is there anything sort of in the offing? Anything new or different?
I don't think so. I mean, it's just more of the same. Something that is very particular to the DeLorean Owners Club is the age of the membership. I mean, I've been in all sorts of classic car clubs, the Austin Counties Car Club, Morris Register, you know, I could rattle them all off over the years. But the DeLorean Owners Club, the average age of our membership is 28 and has been so since I was secretary. Because you get constant stream of young members joining because of the influence of the Back to the Future.
Yeah, I was going to touch on the greying of the hobby, because most of the clubs that I get involved in, like my old Model A and stuff like that, I mean, I'm 57 and I'm one of the youngest members.
Yeah.
So, you know, and that's great. I mean, that means there's new blood coming in all the time and new ideas. And so it's a great way to keep a club going, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, well, I'm 67. I'm one of the old farts. And of course, if you take the average, that means there's an awful lot of really young members.
Yeah,
if there are.
Yeah.
And say that is all down to these films. The youngest member I can remember recruiting was five, and he got a turbocharged DeLorean that his parents had bought him. I'm sure he's still got it, and he'll be 25 now.
Wow.
I mean, this Back to the Future thing is a bit of a mixed blessing.
Yeah, I was going to ask you that, actually. I actually put on one of my points later on, Back to the Future, blessing or curse.
Yeah, well, let's do it now.
Yeah.
If you're going to have a DeLorean, you have to accept the fact that you're going to get an awful lot of people interested in it, comments, what happens when you get to 88 miles
an hour? Yeah, I was just going to say that.
Flux capacitor, you know, all this stuff. Yeah. Well, I actually have got a flux capacitor. When I sold all my DeLorean Back to the Future stuff, I kept the flux capacitor, and it sits in the back of my car. And when they
so
comment,
you can get it out.
It's on. Yeah.
Excellent.
But I mean, if you don't like being looked at, I mean, one of the things I really enjoy about owning the car is the amount of attention it receives.
Yes.
I can't think of any other car, absolutely no other car I've owned, that you can drive down the road and you can see people looking at you.
Yeah.
People overtake you, slow down. It can be quite hazardous on the motorway because they tend to overtake you.
Go
into the inside lane, wait for you to overtake them and photograph you both ways.
Yeah.
I mean, that was absolutely extreme when it was a full Back to the Future car, but an ordinary DeLorean does it anyway.
Yeah.
I mean, I can say without any fear of contradiction that I've only ever seen two what I call free-range DeLoreans. In all my 20-odd years that I've been looking interested in these things, I've only ever seen two that were driving on the road. I'm not talking about when we have an event. I mean, when we have an event like recently in in Norfolk, we had a joint club event, and there was over 40 of them over there.
Yeah.
And, of course, all the roads around Norfolk would be clogged with them.
Yes.
But normally, when you drive in, you know, you just don't see one. So when you're driving, you've got to be conscious of the fact when I'm driving around that people are very interested, because a lot of them, you know, the comments when you actually get to talk to people, I've never seen one before, you know, and
they're all
fascinated by it.
What about the gold ones? I've seen one. I went to the Peterson Museum in Los Angeles a few years back, and they've got a gold one in there.
That's right. Well, there used to be one in the Snyder Bank in Texas. They had the other gold one.
Mm.
And then there was a third one, which was when the company went bust, they'd still got a third set of spare panels. And during receivership, they decided that it'd be a good idea to make the last gold one up. So they got the skeleton crew of engineers who were basically anything on four wheels the receiver wanted to get running. So one of the very last ones they put together, they put a brown interior in it and put all the gold panels on that, and that was the third gold car. That exists. I think that's gone into another collection.
Yeah.
It disappeared for decades and reappeared. In fact, there was a big Sunday Times article about it about 2 years ago. Might have been 3 years ago.
Yeah.
But anyway, those three cars, they're not that practical. I mean, it was going
to...
if you scratch a stainless steel car, you brush it up with a fiber pad and you can't see where you've scratched it. Now, if you've got a gold-plated stainless steel car, if you scratch it, you're going to see stainless steel through your gold.
Absolutely.
So it really isn't a very
practical thing
to have. So they were very expensive, so they just tend to live in museums. They don't get driven around. And to my mind, if you've got a classic car, you might as well drive it and let people look at it.
Use it or lose it, isn't it? That's the thing.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, with the DeLorean, because people are so interested in it, letting them look at it is a very important part of it.
Yeah. There's a guy that I know in the States who does a podcast over there, and he had an interview with the Illinois dealer for the new DeLorean Motor Company. And during the interview, I was absolutely... I didn't realise the slight but noticeable production differences with the different bonnet vents and bits and pieces. And I didn't realise there was that many differences. And then there were some rare wheels and there was this and that. And I just didn't realise that there was, in that short space of production, there were so many little nuances. I didn't actually realise
that at all. Well, I was listening the other day to that thing that I found on YouTube, and Steve Wynn, who is in charge of DMC Houston, and James Espy is second in command. They are the people that are producing the new cars, or will be producing them. And he was saying there were some 3,000 production changes. I mean, some of them will be changing this washer and putting a different screw in it and that. But there was, because the thing got off from a standing start and they'd done it all in such a short record period of time, inevitably there were sort of production changes that went along. And one of the issues they found that when they were pressing the stainless steel, it wears the presses out more than mild steel because it's a more difficult metal to press. And there's a thing called spring bite where the presses have to be adjusted for that. So when they press it and they take the press off it, it comes back a bit. So it all adds to the complications, and particularly the bonnets. You mentioned changes. Well, there were three different sorts of bonnets. The first ones were grooved gas flap bonnets.
Yes.
The second one, they didn't bother with the gas flap, but they still got the grooves. And the third one was completely plain bonnet. I won't say flat. It looks flat, but it's still got curvature on it. But the reason, really, when talking to the buyers, was that it was wearing the tools out so quickly, it was cheaper to keep simplifying the tool than to have a slightly more complicated tool. That was one of the reasons, certainly.
I had heard a story, whether it's an urban myth or not, that some of the tooling ended up weighing down fishing nets or something like that.
Oh, no, it's all in the book. You've not read my book,
No,
have you?
I haven't, no. I'm going to have to talk to you about that after this, about getting a book. So I'm definitely going to have a book off you.
Yeah, well, that's all right. I'll do your deal. And if anybody's listening wants one, I can do them a signed copy at the deal as well.
Oh, I'm going to promote this when it goes out, and I'll make sure that I put that in there for you as well.
All right. Yeah. Well, yes, they did actually. When a company goes bust, I mean, when I got my Derby plating hat on, we actually bought out a couple of companies that had gone bust because you want the equipment. But you always end up with a load of stuff you don't want.
Mm.
Now, when DeLorean went bust, there was lots and lots of doors and things and other panels. Near side front wings, for some reason, they were short of those. But
I heard that.
Anyway, yeah. Well, it's not an issue because they can be repaired or made. But when you've got all these panels kicking around and no cars to put them on, there's not much point in hanging on to the extremely expensive and heavy press moulds. So they all ended up at the scrapyard. You'll read where people said it was a British government conspiracy that nobody could ever start making them again. They were all thrown in the sea. But what actual fact happened is when the company went bust, the scrap man come in and clear up all the stuff nobody wants. Well, it all ended up in a scrapyard in the south of Ireland and sat around in their yard for a long time, all these different bits. They came from the people that pressed the panels, these big castings, Lapel in the Irish Republic, just across the border. So that's why they ended up down there. And, of course, you get people coming there from time to time, like I've done, you know, looking for a bit of scrap metal.
Yeah.
And this
yeah.
particular firm went in there looking for some big, heavy bits because they'd got some salmon fish cages offshore and they wanted things to anchor them down. And he said, oh, just what you want here. Look, all these.
Yeah.
And so they ended up buying a load of them. And I've actually got photos of the ship that took them out. It was called the Seven Princess.
I completely agree with you on the not a conspiracy theory thing, because my dad ran a scrapyard for 25 years. He used to get all manner of things coming in there from Ford Motor Company, press, you know, stuff from presses and everything else. And quite rightly, it would either be cut up and used for something else or melted down or, you know. And if the stuff's in the scrapyard, as you say, someone will come in and use it for something else. It's recycled.
Yeah, and that's what happened. Yeah. Some of the stainless steel was all made by British Steel in Sheffield. It was rolled in Wales. Chopped up and pressed in Lapel in the Irish Republic. And when they went bust, there were some rolls of stainless steel that had not been used. And there's even a little comment in the back of the book. There's a chap, he was an artist actually, Shane Lynch, I think his name is. His piece is in the back. And he went round hunting down all these bits of scrap and things like that. And he ended up going around these scrap yards, and they could remember this stuff going in vividly because, you know, you don't get things that weigh a couple of ton of stainless steel or cast iron coming in all the time. And this steel ended up being used for other things. Some roller shutter doors and doors to a warehouse, all made out of this stainless steel, which should have been DeLorean, wing parts.
What do you feel about what went into production against, as opposed to his vision for the car?
Well, I think that it was very near to his vision. But of course, you know, having a vision and practically having a business which is producing stuff and got to actually make a living, got to earn its keep, there were inevitably compromises as the thing was brought into production. Mm. The two prototypes that had been made in America, properly called concept cars, they were done to basically raise money. They were driven around, they got Citroën engines in them, and the interiors are far from finished. They've got a tiny fuel tank, no room for a spare wheel. They weren't prototype cars. They weren't even pre-production cars. They were concept cars that happened to drive. Now, the finished one looked virtually identical to those, slightly different wheels, slightly different interior, 2 inches longer to get the mechanicals in there. But, you know, your average person wouldn't tell the difference. So the thing that went into production was very similar to what John DeLorean had envisaged all along. But of course, it had been completely redesigned for mechanical purposes by Lotus, who knew that it had got to meet American regulations, and the original design was basically a bit like a Mini, in which it got subframes front and back, a fiberglass composite body with the subframes, which was light and did the job, but they said that it would never pass federal crash tests, and so they agreed with DeLorean that it would have a Lotus Esprit-type chassis, which Lotus just happened to have on their drawing board, and it didn't take a lot to modify it to fit the DeLorean. But, I mean, it was done in such a tight time scale that they had very little choice than to put... It was slightly compromised. They, you know, there was no choice. As it was, they produced the thing in just over 2 years from a green field to a production.
I mean, that's absolutely incredible, isn't it, if you think about it? I mean, from drawing board to on the road in just under 2 years, I mean, you'd never get that happen now.
No,
I mean, you just wouldn't.
Before DeLorean teamed up with Lotus, he actually spoke to Porsche, and they wanted 5 years just to productionize it.
Yeah.
And he hadn't got 5 years.
Unbelievable.
He knew the money was going to be running out very quickly, and it just had to be done much quicker than that.
Yeah. Just on to John DeLorean. I mean, as I mentioned to you the other day on the phone, I've read his book, you know, when he was at GM, and then also the Grand Delusion book. They're the two books that I've read. And just, you know, reading about the guy, he's pretty amazing, I think. The fact that he probably would have been in charge of GM completely before deciding to go off and do his own thing, which is quite
exactly
amazing.
But he was a square peg in a round hole.
Yes.
You know, he was a very good engineer, but he was even better at spotting opportunities.
Yeah.
As he was leading a team of engineers and going around the factory and that, there were quite a few innovations that he saw and realised the potential of and ended up buying the rights to. So he was very good at recognising opportunities.
Yeah. I mean, particularly, I think, what a lot of people don't realise is, and you know well, that all his, you know, his Pontiac days with the GTO and all the rest of it, that he'd been doing this kind of thing from way back, hadn't he?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. He was... although he used to say that he was a good engineer, and I'm sure he was, but he was a bit like Chapman, who was also a good engineer, but they were better at organising things, organising businesses, spotting opportunities, taking advantages of situations. You know, they were entrepreneurs. I mean, they were the Bransons of the day, really.
From what I read of him... the style of the DeLorean actually suited him down to the ground, because he was a very stylish-looking man for his time as well, wasn't he, I think?
Oh, absolutely.
So,
yeah. I mean, that was in the latter years. When he was in his middle years at GM, he snubbed his nose at convention and used to come to work in jeans and open-neck shirts. Now, when you worked at GM and you got over a certain level, you came to work in a black three-piece suit, or two-piece suit, certainly, with the tie and collar and all the rest of it. Well, he went through a phase where he was sort of metaphorically holding two fingers up to GM and said, I'll do it my way. And so I think he was inevitably going to find things a bit tricky trying to fit in with everybody there. And obviously, from his point of view, he preferred the idea of working for himself. He don't have to answer anybody.
No, exactly. Did he do the deal with the British government for the Dunmurry site, or was that done by someone else? Was that his doing?
I mean, he was. He would certainly have the final say in it. He got quite a team of people around him at that stage from America. They were actually, most of the team were holed up in Puerto Rico, where they'd got a deal almost ready to be signed.
Yes, I read that in the book.
Yeah. It was going to be at some former Air Force base out there, and it was, of course, fairly near to America, and it would have suited them quite well.
Yeah.
But when the wind got to the British government in the name of the Northern Ireland office, they thought, well, we could have a go at this. He'd already been sniffing around the Irish Republic, but they'd decided that it was too risky.
Yeah.
But then when the Northern Ireland office got involved, they thought it stood a reasonable chance, and they certainly saw the chance of getting several thousand people off the dole and into work.
Definitely.
And it was, well, the Labour government were in charge at that particular time. That's when the deal was done. And then a couple of years later, but before they'd even started building, Mrs. Thatcher had come into power. And, of course, it was a slightly different complexion then. She was not in favour of subsidising things. She once told somebody, I've got two problems, British Leyland and DeLorean, and I want to get rid of one of them. And that was...
Got rid of the wrong one.
Well, yeah, but you see, that was right towards the end when they were in receivership,
yeah.
When she could have organised Secretary of State to pull the stops out and rev the thing up and get everything working again. But she just wanted rid of one of them. Yeah. And
that was Jim DeLorean Pryor, wasn't it? I think it was Jim Pryor.
Jim Pryor,
that's
right.
Yeah.
It was a flea-by. DeLorean was a tiny thing compared to British Leyland, which was a huge conglomerate. Unwieldy beast, which ultimately went bust anyway.
Well, from a sociological point of view, it was good for the community too, wasn't it? Because you had Catholics and Protestants working there together, and it was as a social thing, it would have been a great success. Let alone anything else.
And the fact that the Protestants came in one door and Catholics came in the other door. Well, that's purely because the site was put between the two communities, and it was easier for them to come in one side than walk right the way around the site and come in the other doors.
Yeah.
But they worked together, and there was no political stuff allowed in the factory.
Right. And
I was talking to somebody who was actually the toilet cleaner, and he said to me, well, he did used to get things scrawled on the wall during the night shift. Except for we'd always got them cleared off by the morning, and it was never an issue.
Because the urban myth was that both of the sort of political organisations on both sides basically said, leave it alone because it's providing jobs and everything else. So it's you don't touch it. So that
absolutely. Yeah. In fact, one of the... I better not mention his name, but he appears in quite a few of the photos, funnily enough. He was just a general worker at the factory, but he was also associated with a certain paramilitary group.
Yeah.
And I've spoken to him on many occasions since, and he's fully in favour of all the peace process, which most of the people are. But in their day, in 1978, when the deal was done to build this factory on a cow pasture, it was a war zone there.
Yes,
it was.
Definitely.
It was outright war. Every single day, things were getting blown up, and people were getting murdered and bumped off. And it was, the country was a dead loss. And I like to think that this factory which sowed some of the first seeds of, normalising the. Of course, we've been back many times. In fact, last time I was there was only about 3 weeks ago. And, it's a lovely place now. All right, you get the odd nutter anywhere. You get them anywhere, in any country. I mean, we've had them in America recently.
We had them in France yesterday.
So you're never going to get rid of that entirely. No. But generally speaking, the place is a wonderful place now. And, I love going there. Me and my wife, we often go.
Yeah. Right, we're getting near the end now, so I've got a final question for you, really, is what might have been for the car and DeLorean, and what do you think might have happened next, and all that kind of stuff?
Well, unfortunately, DeLorean had a slight habit of living a lifestyle of a GM executive when he was on specialist car production. He was the equivalent of... what's that firm in Blackpool?
TVR.
TVR.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, it was not a lot different to sort of a TVR or a Reliant.
Not at all.
But, of course, DeLorean had a very illustrious background, and he flew everywhere by Concorde. He The winter, when they were in receivership, he was going around handing out Rolex watches and Cartier pens to his senior managers when they couldn't afford to pay the supplier bills.
Yeah.
So he was slightly removed from reality from that point of view. And so what might have been, had he been a little less free with the money, they could have got by the difficult times and possibly not had to go into receivership at all. Had the not scaled the production up to such dizzy heights, the quality would have been better, but he got a share option thing that he was launching in America and he wanted maximum production to make that look good. So there were... The man himself, some of the things that made him great also made his actions slightly questionable.
Mm.
But yeah. As I say to many people, there would be no DeLorean car without John DeLorean. So that's the first thing. You know, it's his vision and thoughts and things that got it off the ground. But because he, like most people, had got his weaknesses and his blind spots, he perhaps wasn't the best man then to keep it running. You know,
it's often the way, isn't it? Someone who has the vision and starts a company often then isn't the person to take it on to the next level, I think.
And in all fairness, that's what was the share. Had the share launch gone ahead, had the weather not been so awful in the winter of 81, had some negative press not come out when the share launch was happening, the share launch would have happened. People would have bought shares. Ultimately, DeLorean would have sold out. And the company could still well have been going now.
Yeah.
It's a distinct possibility.
Definitely.
Had he not gone down with his suitcase full of cocaine, the company still would have been going because the rescue deal was all on the table. Barry Wills and a group of them had got they'd done a deal with the receiver and they were just waiting, or just waiting and waiting until DeLorean's option to come up with the money had expired. And of course, we now know that the reason his option didn't expire was because he was being strung along by the FBI, who had got him sorted out as a fall guy for some drugs deal.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any doubt that that it was a setup from start to finish. He wouldn't have gone looking for it. But on the other hand, because he was a bit of an entrepreneur, he got interested before he knew what it was about, and then claimed he couldn't get out of it.
Too late.
What the rights and wrongs of that, we'll never know.
Yeah,
but the fact is that going down in a cloud of questionable dealings meant that the company was absolutely doomed then. There was no way back from that.
That's a good place to end, I think.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I'd like to think that one or two people might like to buy the book.
Cheers, Chris. And I'll speak
to you
soon.
Pleasure to speak to you.